coming up next on RCR. Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. In a topsy-turvy world, good old-fashioned ideas may seem foreign to some, but still make a lot of sense to many. Join Simon as he speaks with local and international guests to explore the values and perspectives that shape our world. Get your common sense fixed with conversations that celebrate democracy, freedom, and our fundamental rights. It's Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Good morning, everyone. Nice to be back here with you on this Friday morning. So welcome to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor. A big thanks to Paul and his team for a great show this morning. It was excellent listening, as always. I hope you will enjoy the next couple of hours. There's almost one theme I'm keeping to this Friday, and that's obviously the attempted assassination of Donald Trump in American politics. This will be of interest to many, but maybe not all. But stick with us, because actually there's a number of guests coming in to give us a variety of perspectives on what's happening. Obviously not just the events themselves, such as the assassination attempt, how media handled it, and so on. But also, what does this mean for the future? In fact, a big part of the show is asking that question. What does this mean for America? What does this mean for New Zealand? What does this mean for other countries around the world? Because if you thought American politics was already in turmoil, I would say it's even more so now. I thought, too, that today I'll spend a little bit more time than usual sharing some of my own thoughts into this space. As many of you will know, I have a great interest in foreign affairs, having chaired the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee in Parliament over a number of years. So I thought I'd just share some of my impressions, particularly around the Trump assassination. But guest-wise, because that's who you enjoy having on, guest-wise, and in no particular order, I have Dr. Reuben Steff coming on. He is a lecturer, a senior lecturer at Waikato University. He'll be talking, obviously, the events in America. I have my good friend Bruce from Maryland. How could I not have Bruce on at a time like this? I call him up. We're going to have a little bit of a chat and get his take on everything that's happening, including the dynamics of the Republican convention, which is on at the moment. I also then, keeping to a theme, have Dr. Anita Abbott on. She heads up a think tank around geopolitical issues. So we have a quick chat around what she sees as some of the big geopolitical issues of today, and particularly in light of what's been happening in the United States. And then I'm also looking to start a new segment. In fact, I'm going to need your help on this, and I'll talk a little bit later about this, but I'll need your help because it's about good people, good organizations in the community. So I'll need your help for a name for that segment. But look, I actually won't say who the first guest is or organization, but I hope you stay tuned and hear there's a little hint of what she has to say. So one of the first, if you will, good sorts that I'm going to be interviewing. And as always, we'll have time for mailbag. There's been lots and lots of feedback this week for the mailbag, particularly around the interview I had with Kylie Black. So as always, if you have any thoughts or comments on the show, on anything we discuss, please get in touch. You can always do that by email, inbox@realitycheck.radio. You can text 2057, or if you're particularly hearing this later in the day or via a replay, why not jump online? There's the RCR Facebook page. There's my Facebook page. Share your thoughts. So sit back, relax, and enjoy with me the next couple of hours as we speak free.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, as I said at the start of the show, the big news in my mind, at least, since we last spoke last week, there's an awkward sentence for you, the big news is the attempted assassination of Donald Trump. Here was me thinking when they had their debate a few weeks ago, where Biden was having a terrible time and Trump, of course, wasn't, well, certainly not in comparison. Here was me thinking things were already stirred up within the political realm of the United States. Obviously, all the speculation around what would or wouldn't happen to Joe Biden. And then all of a sudden, we have the attempted assassination. So it's capturing so much of the news. And as I also said in the introduction, it's captured a lot of my attention. So we've got some good people talking into this today, and I've been fascinated by what's been said already. But I thought actually, for a change, I might extend my thoughts and just talk to them. For some of you who follow me beyond RCR, you will know I write a regular Substack, and Substack's an online op-ed opinion piece. You just write little essays. So I try to write most weeks, and I have one called On Point. And I wrote soon after the shooting my thoughts, and in many ways, nothing's changed. But I thought I'd verbalize it here. And, you know, first and foremost, a horrific incident. The shooting is just beyond the pale. I mean, fundamentally, Joe Biden was right in this, because I thought he was very gracious of how he's handled the situation, that he's spoken to Donald Trump. He gave, I think, a really appropriate commentary from the White House. But Biden himself, as have others have noted, you solve issues in a democracy at the ballot box, not through violence, and certainly not through bullets. But a horrendous action at so many levels. Obviously, trying to kill a man, in this case, Donald Trump, no matter what someone thinks of him, what people think of him, killing is not the answer. And that applies, by the way, to any human. I'm very much have what I call a consistent ethic of life. I don't like killing people, period. It's one of the reasons I don't support the death penalty, for example. Secondly, of course, we did have a civilian die, a father, a husband, a volunteer firefighter. He was killed because, well, the bullets that missed Trump, unfortunately, hit and killed him. Utterly, utterly tragic. And two others seriously wounded, and the shooter themselves. We don't know the motive. We don't know their state of mind. But at the end of the day, this was a 20-year-old young man, 20-year-old boy. He's also dead. So there's many layers to this tragedy. But sad as it is, or was, to me, it's not completely unexpected. Now, I want to be really clear. Didn't know it was exactly going to be targeted at someone like Trump, or was going to happen in this way. But the political rhetoric within the United States over the last few years has been such that an act of violence to me, and you know, to many others, has seemed inevitable. It was only a matter of time. And we've had little precursors, not at a former president or presidential level, but we've had other political representatives targeted, and sometimes fatally. So it's not a complete surprise. But particularly within the Trumpian space, when you've got Democrats in particular, and their friends in media and the general commentariat, particularly amplified through social media, calling this man basically the gravest threat to democracy, akin to some of the worst figures in the 20th century, that he's demonic, add all other descriptors. He was so demonized. And, you know, the narrative being he's such a threat. He's such a threat. It did seem inevitable to many of us that some act of violence against him was going to take place. And it has. It has. And look, it's luck, providence. You can add, or think whatever it was, didn't kill him. And grateful for that. And look, somewhat I think the reverse is true as well. You know, some of the comments about Biden and other political candidates could also lead to violence. And look, you know, there's still many weeks and months to go, and I just pray we don't see any escalation. But that's another point to quickly touch on as well, because, you know, just as I mentioned that some, actually I should really stress that word because it's not all, but some in the Democratic Party had demonized Trump. There's plenty too within that party, and certainly in mainstream media, that have demonized his followers, that everyone who's a Republican is just a terrible, violent person prone to insurrection. And yet, despite their candidate, in this case Trump, being targeted for assassination, they didn't riot. People were horrified, but they didn't riot. And I posed the question in my Substack, in my little op-ed, that had this been in reverse, had there been a shooting at Biden, would we have expected to see no response on the streets? I'd put it to you, I think we would have seen the opposite. I think you would have seen, as we have sadly seen in the past, riots, looting, burning, any excuse for the progressive left to act violently. They'd have been at it. Yet, you know, what's happened with Trump, we haven't seen any of that. And I think that's a positive in itself. Look, how this happened is obviously the part of massive, massive speculation, and rightly so. I mean, it's beyond appalling that this could happen. And in fact, as each day goes by and more information comes out, it just doesn't make any sense. It's just a whole host of failures. And I suppose that's actually part of a definition of anything that's particularly tragic. It's never one thing. It's a multiplicity that all come together. But you had a shooter, this 20-year-old, who was able to get within 150 meters in an elevated position with a direct firing line of a senior political candidate and a former president. That in itself is appalling. It's now clear that civilians minutes beforehand were pointing out to security that the young man was seen not only carrying a firearm, but was getting on to the roof. How on earth could that happen? The response itself was swift once the shots were fired. As I said earlier, lucky that Trump hadn't moved his head slightly. But the security detail, some of them, and look, I'm no expert, so some of you may have views yourself, but they didn't seem to be ready. Part of it, I mean, it sounds so completely minor, but some of them were distinctly shorter than the president. It's very hard to defend somebody, particularly when you're trying to wrap yourselves around them as a literal bodyguard, when you're much, much shorter. So major, major questions to be answered there. Let's see what comes out. Some are suggesting, and I will mention it, that the Secret Service, amongst others, have placed such a focus on their diversity, equity, and inclusion that they've actually made secondary the need for good security. But the other thing I'll quickly add before I speculate on what I think is going to happen for America now, I thought some, again, I want to stress that word, some, but unfortunately a large number of legacy media had hopeless, absolutely hopeless reporting around much of this. In the first few minutes, I can imagine being unsure and not calling it what it was, which was an attempted assassination. But hours afterwards, you had outlets like CNN or the BBC and others talking about Trump having fallen, or that he was just rushed off stage because of an incident. I remember the BBC in particular was saying it was an apparent shooting, and this was like 2.5 hours later. I suppose the key point is, what a remarkable and worrying reluctance by legacy media to call this what it most obviously was. As I say, it could take you a couple of minutes to try and work out what was happening and to report it, but so long afterwards, I think the only explanation is just a complete unwillingness to confront anything to do with Trump. Again, do the reverse. I have no doubt in my mind, had this been shots fired at President Biden, within minutes, they would have been calling it an assassination. They would have been speculating that it's a Trumper or someone. So I think, again, hard to prove because it is speculative, but the media's reluctance to talk to this, clearly, is that the right word for it? Clearly and unambiguously took far too long. And look, finally, where do I think things go from here? In many ways, I actually don't believe this is going to lead to a massive bump in the polls for Trump. I think the politics there is already so polarized. Just do the thought experiment, if you will. Do we really see any Democrat voters changing? And the answer is no. Where it will become interesting, though, is that middle-of-the-road voter and also weak Republicans or weak Republican supporters. I think those supporters who don't particularly like Trump from within the Republican camp will now kick in behind him. Secondly, that the swing voter, I think, will probably lean more into Trump. You've seen that image of him on stage, fist in the air, American flag flying, bloodied but defiant. That's quite a contrast, I think, with a current president who's coming across as weak but senile at times, confused. So I think that'll have an impact as well. So definitely saying an impact will be had. The other final point will be, does this affect Biden staying in the race? I suppose, like everything, there's multiple ways to look at it. Of course, one is he'll stay with the trajectory for a Trump win being more certain now. Who would want to take his place? In other words, leave him there to lose. The flip side, if you're Gavin Newsom or Kamala Harris, you take any opportunity you can, even if the odds look bad. The other is, of course, the contrast now is just so great that they're going to have to replace him. So look, who knows where things will go? But look, remarkable, remarkable events. And my final observation is I don't think we've seen the end of these remarkable events and dynamics. There's still weeks to go before the presidential election, so we will stay tuned.
Our text machine is now live. Send us your thoughts by texting your message to 2057. That's 2057. So get in touch with us now.
My next interview I recorded a couple of days ago. I wanted to tap a number of experts and opinions, and one of them is from a Waikato University academic, Dr. Ruben Steff. He's an amazing man and wonderful insights in the space of foreign affairs, but he was only available before Friday morning, so I decided to do this interview with him then. So a few things are going to be out of date, but I hope you enjoy. Well, as we know, the big topic at the moment is the assassination attempt on former President Trump. It's what everyone's talking about. It's what we're talking about. So I'm very pleased to bring a New Zealand expert in to talk with us this morning. It's Dr. Ruben Steff. He's a senior lecturer at the University of Waikato. He's someone who's quite the expert within the areas of foreign policy, international relations, and security. So I think there's probably no one better within the New Zealand context to have a little bit of a chat to about this. So Ruben, or Dr. Steff, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Simon. Good morning. Great to be here.
Hey, starting someone on the personal side, because I've been putting this to other guests and others on the show, is what was your reaction? How did you first find out about what occurred on Sunday New Zealand time?
Sure, just chucked on the Guardian website, like everyone else, saw the stunning images of Trump, fist in the air, blood across his mouth. And the first thing I thought was, oh, this guy's dead. Like, he's been shot so many times that blood's actually coming out of his mouth like a horrible action movie or what have you. Of course, it turned out it was an attempted assassination. But I would say shock, but in a way not surprise, just given the level of the heightened rhetoric, the intensity, the energy, you might say, in American politics right now, that I think many of us thought it was only a matter of time. So someone took a crack at one of these guys, Trump, Biden, or before them, Obama, you know. But I and like some others, have been trying to figure out what this means for the presidential election. Because everyone jumps to conclusions. Everyone wants to know what this means. And we simply don't know. So I'll have to caveat my comments with that. But, you know, this could very well bolster Trump's prospects. Why? Well, if we just look at the superficial level, he comes out of that attempt and his, you know, fist in the air, screaming, fight, 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 looking strong, courageous. I mean, to have the presence of mind and the political moxie in the moment to respond the way he did after the assassination attempt is impressive, whatever you think of his politics. He looks confident and so on. Turning to Biden, I mean, he presents these days as looking pretty weak and confused. So it's at that very simple, superficial level, this looks good for Trump. But if you think about the voting constituents, what Trump needs is not his base. He's got his base. They're going to be more with him now than ever before. And you're looking at something like 33% of the US population. He also needs Republican moderates, many who have abandoned him in recent years. I suspect some will be coming back to him right now as we speak. I see Nikki Haley is going to speak at the Republican National Convention now. And for a while, she was part of the Republican wing that was a bit hesitant on Trump. But he can potentially leverage this, especially in the convention and his speech in a few days from now, if, as we're being led to believe, he comes out and pushes a unity message. You know, he does the kind of famous Trump pivot that everyone's been waiting for, where one day he comes out and he sort of says, well, yes, you know, I've been aggressive and assertive, but I've come to Jesus and I now want to unify the country. So I think if he does that, I mean, that could very well draw in a lot of moderates. But one other thing is that in 2016, one way he won that election and surprised everyone and shocked even the pollsters, or at least surprised them, was he got a lot of low propensity voters and a lot of voters who had never voted before in a US presidential election. And the polling was missing them because people don't take them seriously. But this could very well drive that. If you're kind of on the fence, you're someone who's not that engaged by US politics, perhaps this assassination attempt, the way he reacted, leads you to get off your bum come November and actually go out and vote at the polls. So that's the case for Trump. This actually will draw in people in the middle, draw in low propensity voters who otherwise just don't care and will sit at home. There's also the argument it could mean very little, that Trump is such a known quantity, and that actually one reason quite a few people don't vote for him, especially in the middle and the suburban housewife and so on, is because he is a vortex of chaos. And that they just want this gone. So even the assassination attempt is viewed by them as just another symptom of the Trump chaotic nature. And they it does not really change the polling. We'll only find that out in the days and weeks to come.
I suppose, too, there's a bit of an element. I wrote about this the other day, that, of course, the Democrats put in a further lens is Democratic voters are unlikely to switch. But as you say, that low propensity voter, I noted, and it was only one interview, one person who, you know, was actually a friend of the man who died, said, you know, he's never voted before, not registered, but will in this case vote for Trump, if you will, out of respect for the volunteer firefighter, husband and father who died. And I suspect too, for what my opinion's worth, that you've got, yeah, those two competing images that, I would use the word iconic now. I try not to use that word often, but the one of the Associated Press of Trump, as you say, fist in the air, the American flag behind him. You couldn't stage it versus Biden. And that's not trying to be partisan. It's exacerbated the imagery between the two of them. I mean, there's some talk that they will now leave Biden to be the candidate. This is a theory from some commentators, and your view would be welcome, that the talk of removing Biden will now stop, will decline, because there's a sense that Trump probably will win. His polls were relatively strong before the attempted assassination, probably stronger now, that a Gavin Newsom and others won't want to step into a losing race. Do you think there's any credence to that?
I mean, it's possible. And in that case, they just leave Biden to dry, hang him out to dry. He takes the bullet. They lose this election and they prepare for the next one. But, I mean, American politics is so high stakes. The individuals involved, Kamala Harris, Gavin Newsom, these are political creatures. I suspect they will think, whatever they think of the chances or odds, they will back themselves. I mean, politicians tend to be pretty optimistic because they've been quite successful in their lives and careers, I find, which is on one hand nice, but actually surprises some people. I think they will still go for it. But, of course, it still requires Biden to withdraw. I mean, they can, at the Democratic National Convention, turn against him and try and pull him out kicking and screaming. But what they don't want is a divided convention, right? Going into the election, a united party is going to be much stronger, especially just given the small margins upon which this election could turn. They've broken down the 2020 election, and Biden only won by a few tens of thousands of votes in a few key states. So I think if Kamala or Gavin Newsom want to go for it, what they will probably do is wait until about a week before the Democratic convention, which is about a month from now, and there will be an orchestrated official switch between Biden and them. But this narrative that they simply won't try because they think they cannot win, I don't believe that. I don't think that's how these people think. I think they want to win at all costs, most of them.
And I found through Greenwich New Zealand politics, politicians, even if things are looking against them, if there's an opportunity to advance, particularly to leadership, politicians take it. It's sort of the old, you know, bird in the hand's worth two in the bush type dynamic. It's like, yep, might not be the opportune time, but there is an opportunity. I mean,
it may never come again, Simon. Who knows? Yeah. 4 years from now.
Yeah. Exactly the point. So why so far is Biden able to hold on? And again, I'm not asking this from a partisan point of view, but you know, he's clearly struggling. The debate was really bad for him. Lots more commentary that mainstream media have turned on him, yet he can still hold on. Is it his legacy? Does he have massive donors? Why is he able to sustain the pressure to remove him?
Well, I mean, the polls have not decisively swung against him. He is losing the polls, but we haven't seen a collapse, some signal that would be like, oh my God, this man cannot win. We also are led to believe he has quite a small circle around him. And his family apparently are key advisors, including Hunter Biden, which is you know, a bit ironic. But so we're led to believe he believes he can win. That's what he said. He said the polling has not indicated to him that he is going to lose. And I think there's also a bit of game theory here, in the degree that, let's say you don't want him to win and you're in the Democratic Party. If you call for him to withdraw and he doesn't, you're potentially are going to be losing favor within the Democratic Party. Now, a number have done that, but it hasn't been a massive groundswell. It hasn't been a majority of Democrats all taking that position yet. So I think that's a fear. We either all do it together, otherwise no one is willing to do it. And as you say, there are other considerations, the money, the funding, endorsements. I gather those, some money has now been put on hold, essentially. So Nancy Pelosi has also been signaling kind of different directions. She's been saying, you know, we support Biden, but we're really waiting for him to make his decision whether he will run or not. Well, he's made his decision. So, but they're signaling Biden like, hey, look, we don't necessarily want you here. We would want you to make the decision, please, for the rest of us, so we don't have to try and pull you down kicking and screaming. But there's a lot of inertia, I think, in the system and in the Democratic Party.
Which is just going to make the election fascinating. As you said earlier, there is so much riding on this. And look, for what my observations are, there are a few Democrats calling on him to go. But when you've only got 10, 15, that might, to a New Zealander, sound like a lot. But in terms of the wider Democratic Party, that's only quite a few, even when it's the likes of George Clooney or a couple of the senators. I mean, at the moment, we've got the Republican conference or convention on. Would you say unity is a really key factor for them? You mentioned Nikki Haley earlier. They got Ron DeSantis to speak and so forth. So do you think the Republicans have got that unity message loud and clear?
Yeah, and that's coming through in the reporting we're hearing from the first day of the convention that was yesterday, that there is the party is surprisingly unified. And only a few months ago, they were not, because Nikki Haley was challenging Trump, and there was a belief that she had kind of a voting block. But again, the suburban housewife who maybe would vote for Nikki Haley, but not Trump. And with her out of the running, those voters might go to the Democrats or sit it out, or at least not go for Trump. With her at the convention, with Ron DeSantis there, it looks like you have a unified party. And the assassination is just, you know, galvanized that even more. So I think, to a lot of people's surprise, we are going to be looking at maybe the most unified Republican Party in some election cycles.
Which will make it formidable, which will be, again, challenging for the Democrats. I don't know about you, I would love to be within their caucuses, if that's the right term, to see all the machinations. But turning more to a foreign affairs lens, when we think of the assassination attempt on Trump, it's an incredibly broad question, but what are the foreign affair implications of this? Is there an impact on New Zealand that you see, or a potential impact?
Sure. Let's have a stab at the general question first. It's very hard to know, isn't it? Because I think we're all processing it. I mean, it's only been a couple of days And we all want to quickly know what this means, this assassination attempt, and we're processing. What I would say, though, is that if you are a foreign leader, let's take Vladimir Putin or the Ukrainians, or turn to the Middle East, the war in Israel, Gaza, and so on. If you are the leaders of one of those countries or groups, and you read the assassination as support, as leading likely to a Trump victory, maybe that does change your actions going forward. Yeah. Maybe Russia decides, okay, well, look, Biden, we couldn't really deal with him. He was providing really robust support to Ukraine. But Trump, well, Trump does sometimes signal something different. He is sometimes a little bit more hesitant or skeptical of such robust aid to Ukraine. He says he can get a deal done on day one and all those very Trumpian things. He just anointed J.D. Vance as his VP pick, and J.D. Vance has been very skeptical of strong support for Ukraine. So maybe this gets Putin to think, well, I don't have to moderate this year. We can dig in and we can wait for Trump to come in. How, if Putin was thinking that Biden was likely to win, he might think, okay, we are going to face a continued robust NATO alliance and Ukraine and support for Ukraine, so we have to fight like hell and there's going to be no compromise here. Maybe with Putin, Trump potentially coming in, he thinks something different. Israel is similar too. Bibi Netanyahu and Donald Trump had a very good relationship. Now, Trump has actually criticized Bibi a couple of times since the attacks against Israel late last year. But nonetheless, Trump says a lot of things. So maybe Bibi thinks, well, if Trump's going to get back in, actually, the very strong, robust support for Israel will be sustained. And of course, Biden has provided pretty strong support for Israel, but he's held up a few arms shipments and sometimes signaled a bit more hesitancy and outright criticism at time of Israel. So again, actors in the Middle East might change the calculations for the coming year. As it comes to New Zealand, oh, geez, Simon, it is just so hard to know. I mean, there is the doom and gloom view where if Trump gets in, who knows what he could do? Maybe he pulls out of AUKUS. Maybe he retreats American military power from parts of the region and so on, the broader Indo-Pacific region and so on. I'd be quite skeptical of that. I mean, it's been more NATO where we've seen Trump, you know, issue signals of some concern about the level of American support and strong concern about how little he has believed NATO states have been doing to help really defend the alliance and therefore defend themselves. But for the Indo-Pacific, I mean, I gather he has spoken actually pretty fondly about AUKUS. J.D. Vance very recently said he supported AUKUS. So I don't know if Trump's approach to our broader region would be much different than his approach was when he was in power, or when the current Biden administration was in. And of course, to Trump, he was the one in 2017 that declared China was a revisionist actor and a strategic competitor and challenge. So for him, China is the major concern. The trade war, of course, comes in from 2017. So I don't know why Trump would be any softer on China than he was when he was in power, or that Biden has been. For us down here, again, we could be accused of free riding. Okay, and not paying our way. And that is, I think, a fair accusation. I think many commentators in New Zealand, even those on the political left, would agree that our military is in a state of disrepair and eventually will need to be rejuvenated. But the Americans, you know, looking at us, if they see our security commitment as showing our commitment to what we might call the broader Western alliance and to America's strategic interest, and Australia, by the way, our only ally, it's possible that they could be quite concerned that there could be some damage to the New Zealand-United States relationship. I would just say, though, that if I look at what Judith Collins, Winston Peters, and Christopher Luxon have all been saying in recent months, it looks like they're aware that we haven't been carrying our weight, and they have been signaling that they want to remain, if not increase our alignment alongside the Australians and Americans and so on, potentially consider joining AUKUS Pillar 2, the technology sharing arrangement. So Trump, I mean, you know, we know he doesn't like to read much, or so we're told. Perhaps he gets a briefing in November or December about New Zealand. There's a few bullet points, and some of those bullet points might say New Zealand has signaled very strong support for US security interests, Western security interests, has New Zealand has issued stronger condemnation of China in recent years than previously. And he simply goes, well, the Kiwis are headed in the right direction. We don't like the fact that they're kind of not spending enough on their military, but they're saying the right things, they're acting the right way. So I'll give the little Kiwi a pat on the head. But I also won't be surprised, Simon, if we do, before he gets to power, if he comes to power in November, see New Zealand announce that there will be an increase in military spending. Because we may feel the need to be sending those signals to the Americans before Trump comes in, if we anticipate he will.
Yeah, it's my suspicion or speculation is that since the assassination, we still have to look at the poll changes and so forth, that actually the calculations within MFAT here in New Zealand, then the Prime Minister's office and other ministerial posts will be, okay, it's more likely now that we could have a Trump presidency. What does that look like? And you touched on defence. I think this current government is making, despite my previous career and biases, I think they are making the right statements. The problem is they haven't yet put the money there. You know, the defence budget's gone backwards in the recent budget. And the Americans, well, I know through my own sources, have noted that. So it could be interesting, as you say, to see if there's a preemptive strike. That's the wrong way to phrase it, but there's some preemptive actions in that regard. I mean, you touched on the likes of Russia and China. I mean, do other authoritarian or at least non-democratic countries look at what happened around the assassination and go, look, this is why democracy doesn't work? In other words, is there an opportunity here that these guys, these authoritarian regimes, are going to try and exploit, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the propaganda in recent years has been about trying to attack and undermine democratic norms, our commitment to transparency, the rule of law. We know this through recent reporting. Anne Applebaum in The Atlantic had a really great article recently called The Propaganda War, where she talks about Iran, Russia, and China all using really intense propaganda now around the world to try and undermine our system and undermine the view of our system in the eyes of countries in the global South, who maybe are looking at China's autocratic system, looking at the Western democratic system, and they're considering, well, what system do we want? Which is functional? Which brings sustainable economic growth? And this assassination could very well be viewed as a sign of a dysfunctional democracy, and the democracy is inherently unstable. So yes, I think this will assist their case in making that, and they will be trying to make that as we speak, I'm sure, through social media and other propaganda vectors.
You mentioned Iran, and as we're actually sitting down, I think it's CNN is breaking the news that there's Iran was looking to sponsor, I'm not sure the right terms, but was looking to sponsor or be involved with an assassination attempt on Donald Trump, and that actually security had supposedly been increased around them. Is this something you've begun following or aware of?
I have not. I mean, there's so much to follow at the moment, Simon. It's pretty easy to miss things here or there. So no, I haven't. But we'll be hearing about those stories to come, I think. It's also, Simon, that this assassination, I mean, we're looking at it as an infliction moment or event. This could be the first of a number of events in the months to come, where I don't know if that attempt will be overshadowed, but, you know, violence can beget violence. And who knows what other individuals, groups, parties, or countries might have up their sleeve to try and influence this election in the next few months.
Yeah, well, as you're pointing out, there's still a lot of water to go under the bridge. You know, even just on the political realm, we've got the Republicans and their convention. The Democrats still have to have theirs. Yeah, there could be much, much change. I mean, do you feel, and probably final question, and it's looking into a crystal ball, but do you think the Americans can pull themselves back from this hyper-partisan, high-level rhetoric back to a more civil discourse, or are we on an inevitable trajectory here?
To be determined. I think Trump's speech this week is an opportunity, potentially, for us to start walking back from the direction America has been headed on. If he goes in the other direction and he says in this speech, look, we know that the media are trying to get me. We know the courts are trying to get me. We know the liberals are trying to get me. And now we know they're even trying to kill me. Then all bets are off. But from what we hear, he is going to go for a unity message. We are hearing reports that actually he's been in a sort of reflective mood since the assassination. He's gone through maybe a bit of a spiritual shift. I think we should remain skeptical until we see some real signs of that and whether it sticks beyond a few days or not. But I think his speech this coming, I think it'll be Friday our time, will tell us if this moment is something that can hopefully be viewed in retrospect as shifting the tone back away from polarization and antagonism and so on in the US polity.
Well, if you're agreeable, we'll have to bring you back on after this week's show, after he's given his speech. Because as you say, I saw footage of him coming into the Republican convention and he looked a slightly different Trump. But as you say, let's see how long it lasts or not, but would love to get your impressions. Dr. Steph Rubin, thank you so much for your time and insights and also the important work I know that you lead through your academic and research side. So thanks for being part of the show.
Thanks, Simon. Great to be here.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, someone I've had the good fortune to be involved with within the foreign affairs space is Dr. Anita Abbott. She's the chair, the founder, in fact, of something known as APSI, which, of course, is an acronym. It's for the Asia-Pacific Security Innovation Forum. And Anita joins me now. Dr. Abbott, lovely to have you on the show.
Thank you, Simon. Lovely to have you here, too. Thank you.
Well, hearing your voice again reminds me of an excellent forum that I had the good fortune to join that you had organised a couple of years ago down in Queenstown, of all places, which was marvellous in itself. But a lot of listeners will not have heard of APSI before, the Asia-Pacific Security Innovation Forum. So tell us what this is all about. What is this forum? What do you focus on? And what are the important issues?
Well, Asia-Pacific Security Innovation, or APSI Forum, was established in April 2019 when I came back from NATO Defense College in Rome. And our first summit was attended by 38 delegates from Thailand, Indonesia, Australia, India, Israel, New Zealand, the Philippines, the United States, Germany, and Canada. APSI Forum is a forum dedicated to the domain of geopolitics, international relations, and defense. It holds several events such as summits, colloquium, congress, strategic forum discussion, and recently we held a geopolitical cooperation Haiti in Auckland. It was informal discussion over an elegant afternoon tea that highlights the importance of collaboration and networking among international stakeholders. APSI has three divisions. The first one is the forum. The forum provides a platform for ambassadors, political figures and leaders, and military leaders to interact and share knowledge and experience. And basically, the forum aims to strategically utilizes geopolitics and diplomacy to cultivate partnerships that shape geopolitical dynamics. The second division is Center of Excellence, where there are many academics here. The Center of Excellence has collaborative research, a network of advisory groups and preparatory action research for strategic studies. And the next one is Community Hub. Last year, we had former child soldiers and widows who live in extreme poverty, where some of our networks were able to assist them, to support them. There are three of them.
And, oh, it's a lot. Yeah. It's a lot. I remember coming to one of the forums and speaking, and if I might, and for listeners to get a bit of a sense, it's a wonderful networking opportunity. You've got a great ability to bring, as you say, ambassadors, defense experts, public relations experts, theorists, academics, politicians, as I was at the time. And it was just fascinating to hear the different perspectives. So, I mean, clearly very successful because this is continuing on. You do this every year.
Yes. Thank you. Yes, I think so. I think we are doing well. Thanks.
One of the things I know listeners will be really interested in is obviously your perspectives of what's happening in the United States at the moment. We obviously have a presidential election and the attempted assassination. But before we get there, I know part of your particular focus is around the whole geopolitics within Oceania, particularly, if I might use the term currents, that the geopolitical currents that affect smaller states. So I wonder if you could just talk us through a few observations there, and how small is a smaller state?
Well, we actually focus on global geopolitics, but we also touch on small states. New Zealand and other small states in Oceania. New Zealand and other states in Oceania have challenges because they are small states. For example, they are heavily reliant on a limited number of industry or trade partners. And also, the challenge is to maintain neutrality or balanced relationship between competing major powers. What is more, external influences may dictate their domestic and foreign policy, and this will lead to a loss of independent action. So for this reason, there is formidable task, but necessary, of course, is to carefully navigate international alliances and partnership in order to avoid being drawn into conflicts or power struggles. So when we talk about small states, we different scholars will define them differently, but it will depend on the characteristic of small states, like what I just mentioned. Some of them is relying on trade partners and so on.
Do you think the way forward for New Zealand, well, is there any advice? Maybe I could phrase it that way. Is there any advice from your academic experience and the work through the forum of how New Zealand should navigate these tensions? Is it about more diplomacy? Is it about more public discussion? What are some of the things we should consider to help us through these tensions?
Certainly, diplomacy will play important roles in order to maintain neutrality or balancing relationship, and also in order to navigate international alliances and partnership. Continued diplomacy is the first, or I think a smart approach, the first and smart approach for a small state like New Zealand in global geopolitical dynamics. What else can I say? New Zealand should be aware, of course, of international external influences, because it will dictate New Zealand foreign policy and, of course, domestic policy. Yeah.
Absolutely. I think I'm slightly biased on this, Dr. Abbott, having been targeted by some foreign influence currently in the news, that, you know, it's got to be exposed right across the spectrum so that, again, New Zealanders in this case have their eyes wide open. I mean, turning to the United States, as I say, this has been the big news of the last, 2 weeks. We had obviously the Biden-Trump debate, you know, a growing and tense, if you will, presidential election, and then only a few days ago, we had the attempted assassination of Trump. I don't know if you've got any general impressions there, but I know that you do have thoughts around if we end up with a Trump presidency, how that might affect allies such as, I'm thinking, Japan, South Korea. So, yeah, any impressions of what's happening there?
Well, it is interesting, really, because nervous allies such as South Korea, Japan, and the Philippines. I would say they are nearest allies. They have different position, of course. I read from Financial Times today about South Korea. It says that the sophistication of North Korea's nuclear program and its closer relationship with Russia, and of course the possibility of Trump to be elected, have contributed to the growing public support in South Korea for developing its own nuclear arsenal. With regard to Japan and the United States, it will depend on who shaped the foreign policy there. There can be two implications or two possible scenarios. The first one is that the U.S.-Japan alliance is stable if Trump is elected. Again, it will depend on who shaped the foreign policy. For example, if Filbury or Colby or O'Brien are in the House, then it will be different. And the second scenario is bandwagoning. Possibly some might argue that bandwagoning is not likely to happen. But it is worth to consider this. Bandwagoning, when we talk about bandwagoning, it is a state aligned with a stronger and adversary state. So the question is China ready for a closer alliance with Japan and vice versa? So that's my thought on South Korea and Japan as nearest partner, nearest allies if Trump is elected.
Which I think brings us back to where we started, is that ultimately this forum that you run, APSI, is about drawing people together to discuss the geopolitical challenges of today.
That's right. That's right. And I'd like to say that there are several security or emerging security issues and challenges that APSI has discussed. And has discussed. The first one is great power rivalries. Salience example is the tension between major powers like the US, China, and Russia, and the ramification on global stability and regional alignments. What I mean by ramification on global stability is that there will be new allies, new partners, and bandwagoning, and possibly new bloc. And in this case, when we talk about China, the West need to have a clearer picture of what China wants to achieve. And second issue is related to territorial disputes and maritime security, such as the disputes in South China Sea, and also potentially rivalries between India and China in the Indian Ocean region, and possible escalation in Taiwan Strait and Red Sea. And the next one, of course, we know this, the spread of nuclear weapons and technology, particularly concerning countries like North Korea and Iran. APSI has discussed this. APSI discussed the spread of nuclear weapons, not only about North Korea and Iran, but also Pakistan and India. We had rep from India and rep from Pakistan, and they discussed the development of the nuclear weapon. And the next issue is the rise and spread of terrorist organization, which will impact on global security. And this will require international cooperation. The last thing that I want to say is the formation and evolution of alliances such as the Quad and NATO, and this will influence regional powers dynamics.
I was just going to say a big thank you for coming on to the show and talking us through. I hope that listeners can actually take away some confidence that people like yourself and others involved with APSE are actually touching on the big issues. So again, thank you for chatting with us.
Thank you for having me, Simon. Thank you.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, it's been a huge week in America, and that's putting it mildly. Obviously, the story which everyone is talking about is the shooting or the attempted assassination of former President Trump. So, as you would expect, I have turned to my good friend and source of all things political in the United States. Bruce, welcome back to the show.
Well, good day from the USA. Hi, Simon. How are you today?
Well, I'm doing exceedingly well. It's another beautiful winter day here in New Zealand. I suspect you are melting there in Maryland.
Winter. I forget you guys have winter. You know, we're at just a little above 40 degrees centigrade. So then you throw in some humidity on top of that. So
Well, things have certainly heated up in America. I mean, look, all the talk is about the attempted assassination of President Trump. I mean, take us through your impressions. I mean, when did you find out? What were your initial reactions? Yeah, talk us through it.
Well, it's funny. I was at a movie with my granddaughter, and as we were coming out of the theater, my wife said, "Hey, it sounds like Trump has been shot." And I'm like, "Oh, come on." I had no idea it was happening in real time. It was just, we both looked at each other and said, "What? How do you get a shooter on a roof from 100 yards away? Who is he? What is he?" All the questions. And it turns out it was just a catastrophic failure to protect the president, or just an obvious, where were the Secret Service on an open, unprotected building about 100 yards from where Trump was standing. And that's just not done. He was already kind of on their radar screen about a half hour before this character. We know him now as Thomas Crooks. He's a 20-year-old guy. Are you with me?
I am. I'm listening intently.
Oh, okay. He was about a 20-year-old guy, and Thomas Crooks had been wandering around. He had a scope in his hand and the rifle. Secret Service spotted him, thought he was a threat, kept an eye on him, but still allowed. And then he disappeared, and they still allowed Trump to go to the podium and begin speaking when you've got an unknown threat happening. And that was for like 30 minutes. People were starting to see him on the roof saying, you know, "Shoot her on the roof, shoot her on the roof." And then there it is. It was a miracle, an absolute divine providence that Trump is not dead.
Had he turned his head slightly, what? He would have been gone. I mean, are the American people just furious at the Secret Service? I mean, do they see this as incompetence?
Yes, it was. Her name is Kimberly Cheadle. She's the Secret Service director. There are a lot of questions. She's going before Congress for an investigation next week. It was just so unbelievably negligent that they had then put, they had outsourced the protection to the local and the state for the individual protection. And then naturally, Trump, as a former president, has his ongoing protection. But it just, how do you make that kind of a blunder? Was there intent is a question. Just a crisis of communication was really, really bad.
Well, that's come a that certainly yeah, came across from some of the footage of
questions are very angry.
So has it changed the calculation then? No, well, has that changed the calculation for the election? Some people are saying this means that Trump will now romp home because of the sympathy vote and so forth. But, I mean, what's your take? Is it still going to be a close race? Has this attempted assassination, though, changed things?
Yes, the world changed. People are starting to kind of go, wow, you know, after the debate debacle, what a week it's been. The debate debacle, and then you've got this Trump as a, and then now there's Republican convention, and he's named his vice president, vice president nominee, J.D. Vance. So, yeah, there's a tidal wave of Trump going through the United States, and Biden is kind of they've kind of lost confidence. There's no enthusiasm in the campaign. Biden was kind enough to give Trump a call after the shooting, just, you know, gentlemanly call, say how you doing.
I thought that was very gracious.
Yes, it was. It was. I got to give him credit for that one. But it's now become almost a fait accompli. Unless something happens. Who knew there was going to be a shooting? And then with the whole spotlight on the Republicans and the naming of J.D. Vance, now there's a character. He's amazing.
Talk us through this guy. I mean, he's young, millennial, used to be against Trump, vocally against Trump. So tell us who he is first and foremost, and admit, I have to say this, you have to admit you picked wrong. You were a Tim Scott.
Yeah, well, I didn't get first place. I think I got show. Tim Scott, he's still there. He's still a player. Yes, I really had my chips on the table for Tim Scott, but J.D. Vance, he is the American dream. I mean, he is what this country is based on. He wrote a book called The American Elegy, or Hillbilly Elegy. Hillbilly Elegy, which Netflix came up, and they've made a movie out of it. And
yeah, Glenn Close is in it.
Amy Adams. Pardon?
Glenn Close is in it.
What did you say? Yeah, it's Ron Howard directed it. Amy Adams is in it. Glenn Close plays his grandmother. And he goes from absolute dirt poverty. They were just totally poor, with alcoholism and just all those problems. He rose to become a Marine. He served time in Iraq, came back, got the GI Bill, went to college, was accepted at Yale Law School. He's a Yale Law School graduate, super smart. I'm just wicked smart. And now he's only a junior senator. He's only been there 2 years. He's 39 years old. And he's got a wife and kids, and he's the American dream. I mean, it's a heck of a story.
Is part of the reason he was chosen, Bruce, amongst obviously an amazing story and life of service. I always take my hat off to anyone who's served in the military. But is it also that he's the representative of Ohio, and that's a really important swing state? Because I remember you telling me Tim Scott was from, and I've forgotten which state, I'm afraid, was it Carolina? But Trump didn't need votes.
Tim Scott's from South Carolina, and he will have a position somewhere. It's not going to be vice president. Vance, he is from dirt poor Kentucky, and has, you know, as he got older, he's moved to Ohio and is now the junior senator. Ohio is a pretty solid conservative state, but he speaks the talk of the youth. And so he can get to Michigan and Minnesota and Pennsylvania and those states that that would really help on the Trump side. And they're battleground states. So Trump just give him his walking papers and say, okay, spend the next 4 months in Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, and get to Virginia too when you can.
Well, it looks like their campaign has enormous momentum. And I noticed, too, the Supreme Court, another win, if you will, for Trump, have come out and said that most of the charges related to him storing secret or confidential documents can't stand. So Trump's having quite the week, from being shot at, naming a vice presidential candidate, the court decisions. He has enormous momentum.
It's unbelievable. he just has that je ne sais quoi to become the center of the story all the time. Who knew that? How he dodged getting killed it was a miracle. And then you've got the iconic fist in the air as he's, you know, I'm fine, fight, fight, fight. I mean, that looks like something out of Iwo Jima. He's amazing. And yes, he's had one heck of a good week. SCOTUS, Supreme Court, a judge in Florida, because the case is a Floridan case, said the prosecuting attorney, it can't try the case because he's a private citizen. He has not been vetted by the legislative branch of our government. We've got checks and balances. And he was not vetted by the legislative branch, the judicial committee, if you will. So based on that, no deal. Get another attorney and start again. So, yes, it went all in Trump's favor. It was the files that were locked in a vault in the Mar-a-Lago, that whole Mar-a-Lago raid and everything that you may remember. That's all gone and disappeared.
And on top of all that, we've had the Republican convention. I assume that's just been, for timing, serendipity, for want of a better word, for the Republicans, they couldn't have got a bigger showcase. And I notice the likes of Nikki Haley, Marco Rubio, and Ron DeSantis, amongst many others. I mean, a lot of these, the three I mentioned, competed against Trump, but they were speaking at the convention. What's this all about?
Unity, unity, unity. They want a show of a solid force of a single voice, if you will. We are here and we are happy and we, come join the party. Yeah. And for me, I don't know, maybe a cocktail party, but just kidding. With Nikki Haley and, the Republicans have got just the deepest bench I've seen in decades, where there were
huge
Democrats,
huge energy. I mean, you've been there. Must be quite the party.
Yes. Well, especially when you got a winning candidate. I was there, gosh, back in 1988. I was on the podium when Daddy Bush, George Bush Sr., accepted the nomination for presidency, which was, that was in New Orleans a million years ago.
When we're all young.
And now the Democrats. Then you're going to have the Olympics, which is going to be wall-to-wall, and then the Democrats. And then they have their show. And so we'll just have to wait and see. Never a dull moment this summer.
Well, last question before we
didn't get to do this 4 years ago, so COVID stopped it. So this is all kind of new, and it's the shiny new penny. It's the flavor of the month. Big thing. Shooting, well, vice president, convention, court decisions, the media is turning tail and embarrassed.
Well, that's been a big change, as we discussed last week. I've seen in the news a couple of days ago, it was, I think CNN broke the news of an alleged Iranian plot against Donald Trump. I mean, is that getting much airtime at the moment?
Yes. It is another failure of the Secret Service. They just need to fire everybody and start again. I think it's not going to happen. It was a failure where Department of Homeland Security and Secret Service, they've confirmed that there was an Iranian plot that they've been keeping an eye on just before President Trump, or former President Trump, was to speak in Pennsylvania. So therefore, they had increased their footprint, if you will, with more Secret Service agents. But it boggles the mind how you could just make such an obvious error to leave a roof unexposed or unprotected, fully exposed, 100 yards from the president, former president of the United States. It's just boggles the mind. We took out Soleimani, so now I guess they've got a vendetta or something.
Well, there's no shortage of, in inverted commas, exciting things happening in the States, but also I imagine there's a long way to go before we reach, obviously, Election Day. But Bruce, thank you, as always, for coming on and chatting with us.
It is an absolute pleasure every week. And stay tuned. America, we're nuts. But we are 350 million people strong with 350 million opinions. And stay tuned. Thanks, Simon.
Great having you on the show.
Appreciate it.
Gotcha.
Bye-bye.
Check out our brand new RCR Foundation Members Club. Go to realitycheck.radio/members and join now.
So I'm looking to start a new segment for the show, and it's something I actually need your help with as listeners, because amongst many things, I am not particularly creative. And in this term, I need a name. I need a name for this new segment because it's about good people and good organizations in our community. I, you know, have been involved with and supported a number of charities over the years, as I'm sure many of you have as well. And I've been really keen to bring them in. Week after week, to bring in a different guest, a different organization to tell us what they do. But I'm really struggling, I have to admit, of what to call it. I know other channels have talked about good sorts, so we can't use that because, well, obviously it'd be like a plagiarism. But I'm trying to think of what a good title for this segment would be. As I say, and I've got a guest lined up, she's coming on in a moment. What could I call this segment? If you've got thoughts, please let me know. Email me at inbox@realitycheck.radio or text 2057. But listen to the next interview. You'll get a sense of what I'm trying to do. But again, it's good people, good organizations doing amazing work in the community. And I just love a title for the segment. But let me know what you think about our next guest, and let me know what you think of, well, what could be a good title? Well, I'm really excited to introduce my next guest. She's the CEO of a charity called Upside Youth Mentoring. Some of you may know it from times past, called Brothers in Arms. But Jenny Horst joins me now. Jenny, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's so lovely to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
It's an absolute pleasure. I should declare for listeners, I know Jenny, in fact, Rachel and I joined her and the crew from Upside a few months ago for a fundraiser. They do amazing work, hence wanting to have you on the show, Jenny. So without me talking too much, which is still a hangover from my political days, tell us about Upside. What do you guys do?
Oh, look, I love talking about this stuff. If you're looking for an upside in a world where there's so many things that are pressing down on us, you know, at a local level or nationally or internationally, you know, life is a bit complex out there, isn't it? It's always good to zero in on what's going well. And we love telling the story of life on the upside. So at Upside Youth Mentoring, what we do is we help facilitate life-changing relationships for young people that have had a tough start in life. And that might be because they've experienced some of the heavy stuff like neglect or abuse. They might be being bullied. They might have experienced extreme grief, perhaps lost a parent and really struggled to move forward with that. There are all kinds of reasons why a young person, and we're talking about kids that are 9 to 13 years of age, so right at that pivotal time of life where they're individuating and changing so much physically and mentally, socially, right at that time, what we're able to do is enable some early intervention, if you like, through amazing positive role models that come into their life. And it really helps change that trajectory for them from what might be a predisposition to some fairly poor life outcomes as a result of these challenging things they've had in their life to something that is a whole lot more positive. And we're just seeing story after story, and the researchers that we've had done on the organization is backing this up, that the outcomes are just absolutely magnificent, that are coming out of just ordinary people journeying with a young person and bringing that big heart, some good laughs, a bit of caring every week for across a year, actually. The journey is about a year long, and many go a lot longer than that.
So how do you find these young people? I'm assuming, so that listeners understand, this is primarily in Auckland at the moment, or have you spread further? And secondly, how do you find these young ones, or how do they come to you?
Yeah, well, firstly, we are primarily based in Auckland. So Southeast Auckland and Central West Auckland are our two primary hubs. Having said that, there are other organisations outside of that that are running our program themselves. So we go as far as Tauranga. There's one up North Rodney. We've got about 5 charities in different places. So if anybody's listening and thinking, oh, I want to hear more about that, we can potentially plug you in wherever you are to something that we're doing in the program. Or if we don't have a presence in the community that you're in, we're able to connect you with another like-minded mentoring organization. So bear that in mind as you listen to this interview, there might be an opportunity for you to engage. But to your second question about how we find the young people, what we've done over the years is had referrals from a number of sources, but the most powerful source for referrals that we've found is the local school, because they're walking alongside this young person on a daily basis. They're seeing them day in, day out, and what challenges they might be presenting with at school. They invariably know the family as well, and they have contact with local agencies that are wrapping around the families that have more complex needs. So they're in a prime position to be able to brief us really well on where that child's at and what they need. And from there, we sit down with that young person and with their family and just see if they're ready for this kind of journey and if it would benefit with them. And obviously, we're doing the same with our volunteer mentors as well, just engaging with them and looking for that perfect fit and matching them, bringing them together.
So perhaps, I don't know if there's a story or two without breaking a young person's privacy, but what does that look like? I mean, what's, if you will, the stereotypical situation a young person might be in between those ages of 9 and 13 that needs extra support? And then what does it sort of look like with the mentor? What are these volunteers doing to assist the young person to be, well, the person they want to be and taken to the upside? I'm trying to find a funny way to bring upside in, and you're better at it than I am.
It's a useful word, isn't it? It's a nice one. It always lights me up when I say it. I just think it so much embodies what we're doing. Look, I'll share a real quick story. There was a woman that I spoke to not so long ago whose child was 13 when we first matched him. And at the time she said, this was 8 years ago. At the time she said, I thought his future was one of two things, suicide or prison. And she turned around and said, thank you so much. You really changed that. So he's now doing super well. He's 20 years old. He's a scaffolder. He's getting out there every day doing a wonderful job at his work. He's loving his life, and he now wants to be a mentor himself. So that's sort of the gorgeous journey for some people. But I'm thinking of a young boy, and we'll call him Tony, who was who moved to New Zealand at very short notice from Tonga with his family and had a lot of trouble settling into the local school. He started getting bullied by the other kids and developed a nervous tic because of this, and that brought more bullying. So very quickly, he worked out he needed to have a coping strategy. And unfortunately, his coping strategy was violence. So he was modeling something that he'd seen at home. And he started becoming the school, aggressor, if you like, and was very problematic in this, in both the classroom and the schoolyard. So the school reached out to us and said, look, this young man needs someone to walk alongside him, a mentor, one of your mentors. So we matched him up with a guy that was quite athletic and really had a passion for life. And this young boy changed very, very quickly from being an aggressor to really settling down, learning new coping skills, and then becoming a school leader. So a massive 180 for this kid. He's now a child that the school says other children are looking up to. He is someone that gives advice during assemblies, and he's settled down at home as well, so he's not being aggressive to his sister, and his family are saying, wow, this is incredible. We're thinking, are there any other elements in his life that have changed? But both the school and his family are saying the only thing that's changed is that this volunteer mentor that you matched him with has been turning up every week, spending time with him, kicking a ball around, having some fun, doing, the mentors do all sorts of things with their young people. In this case, it was reasonably sporty activities. And they walked together for a year. And my goodness, this kid changed from, obviously being in a place where he was deeply unsettled and probably likely to continue on that trajectory, to a young kid that now believes in himself. He's giving back to the people around him. And is very likely to move to, well, the research is showing regarding our program, he's more likely to get a higher qualification. The research is showing our kids are getting, having improved mental and physical health. They're less likely to offend, less likely to have addictions and experience violence in their future. So it's a super good news story. And Tony kind of encapsulates that quite well.
I know there were a few other stories that were shared at that fundraiser. And I have to say, it's incredibly inspirational. I suppose it's some of the key work that you and your team lead is linking that young person with the right mentor. And I suppose, too, there's no one size fits all, but it's ultimately about relationship, I suppose, that this young person knows that there's someone that will turn up, as you say, each week, but also they can contact, discuss, talk, kick a ball around. And it's just fantastic to hear, Tony's story, what a difference it makes. And I suppose the other thing is we're talking thousands of young people now, aren't we, over the years that Upside's been around. This is not just three or four young people that we're discussing.
We work with about 100 a year. We've been around since 2006, albeit in the early days there were much fewer numbers as the team was small and it was starting out. You touched on a word that I think that is useful to unpack a bit, which is relationship. And I've seen over the years in the charitable sector a lot of programs implemented and lots of numbers going through those programs. But the most powerful mechanism for change, I believe, is relationship. It seems to be when people feel somebody cares about them and sees them as a person rather than a problem. It's a catalyst for a lot of deep, meaningful, sustainable change. And that's why this program has been developed based on international best practice, by the way. So we're really ensuring that we're working with a proven program. By virtue of matching up a volunteer, they're not paid to be there. This young person sees somebody cares enough to turn up week after week, and the minimum requirement we have is a couple of hours a week, and they stick with them for a year. And some people are, getting into the kitchen and baking a cake together. Others are playing a board game or doing some arts and crafts or going to a museum or walking the dog on the beach together. It's not so much what you're doing. It's just doing life together and holding space. The mentor holds space for that young person and at the right times, ask some good open-ended questions that might provoke some deeper thought for the young person about other ways to cope with the situation. And slowly but surely, the young person opens up. But it's that belief in them that's incredibly powerful in delivering these amazing results. So it's quite rewarding. Not only is that young person experiencing the change, but the stress in the household reduces, according to the research on our program, and the mentor's own well-being improves, which is an amazing good news story for us to tell, because I think turning up to such a thing, a mentor feels like, hey, I'm sacrificing a couple of hours a week and I'm doing this because I believe you know, it's worth giving back to the community around me. But in fact, over that journey, there's such a profound change in them too. So the things that I'm hearing from my mentors is that their life feels a whole lot more purposeful, that they're more in touch with their own humanity. They get to play again as well, you know. We don't often have excuses to go and just unplug and just kick a ball around and have a laugh or play a game. So it's really lovely to have permission to do that. And as that relationship deepens, there's those gorgeous rewards of seeing the change over time, that young person growing in confidence and self-belief and looking at their future quite differently.
Well, you preempted one of my questions, because, of course, we're thinking about the young person, but it's obviously the mentors are absolutely critical. And you pre-answered some of it, because I was going to ask you, what is it that you want in these mentors and volunteers? Because I know you'll always want more, and that's an encouragement to listeners to consider. But you've clearly said that they build in their relationship happiness, joy, by being involved. It's not overly time-consuming, you know, a couple of hours a week. But, well, put it this way, what's your pitch to people to become a volunteer on top of what we've already discussed?
Look, I think it comes down to, in a nutshell, every young person is a success story if they have a caring adult around them, or can be a successful story if they're living out of some level of vulnerability. And so in stepping up to be that for somebody, you are releasing incredible potential in a young person who has some genuine needs. But not only that, you are, by virtue of your own contribution, your world is expanding. And there's some interesting recent research on the benefits of stepping out of your comfort zone and engaging in ways with people around you that you might not have thought about doing before. In fact, more happiness is found on those edges outside of your comfort zone. So I had a lady turn toward me as she was leaving one of our events. We run a few fun events through the year for the matches. And she said, "Thank you so much for enabling me to be part of this. This is the best thing I have ever done in my life." And she was a woman in her 50s, so I'm sure has had a lot of life behind her and probably done
some young
magnificent
woman.
Young woman.
I need to say that because my wife, in case she's totally listening.
So she's done a lot of great things in her life, I'm sure, because she was a big-hearted person. But this was quite a profound experience for her, because it was opening up a whole new world to her and giving her this wonderful sense of purpose. So she was finding it at least as rewarding as that young person that she was walking alongside. And you asked what we're looking for. It's a couple of hours a week, as I said. It's for at least 12 months commitment. And that 2 hours a week could be on a Saturday one week and a Thursday another week. It's flexible. It can work around you and the young person you're working with. We match you together quite carefully. We look to ensure that there's an alignment of interests and personality. We obviously put people through a bit of a vetting process. There's a pretty rigorous process there, a police check and other things to ensure that we have safety and well-being top of mind for our young people. They need to have a driver's license, these volunteers, and a vehicle, so they can pick the young person up and go do fun things together and be ready to come to some fun events through the year. There's also an overnight camp. And other than that, it's about just being a good, decent, big-hearted person and up for an awesome journey.
So many upsides. Sorry, I've got to stop trying to find
puns. There you go. Well, you're playing my game now. You're getting that word in every way you can. I love it.
I mean, the other side, of course, and sort of final thought is you obviously need funds. People, you know, in this space always need funds. And, you know, please tell us how to get in contact with you. But I know that you've had, if you will, a social investment lens put across you, that for every dollar given, there's a really substantial return. So let listeners know the value for money, the wonderful value for money beyond the care and, beyond the care itself of young people. Why is donating to Upside a good thing?
Oh, look, it is important that people know that their money is being invested in a way that is going to generate change. So we've engaged an outside agency. It was set up by Sybil English, actually, called Impact Lab, and they quantify social impact. So it's a reasonably new science, and it's incredible. So they layer many data sets together, including the organization's data and international data, domestic and government data, and look at the good generated and the harm avoided through that particular program. And what's come out of that is that for every dollar invested in Upside's program, there's $4.70 of social good generated. Isn't that fantastic? It's such an encouragement to people that thinking about giving, because they know, you know, with great confidence that we steward those funds really well, and that it absolutely generates the change that we are professing that it does.
Well, I just think it's marvelous. As I said at the start, you know, Rachel, longer than I have, but now through Mary and her, have known about your work, love what you do. So, Jenny, a big, big thank you to you and your team for all that you do. If people want to become a volunteer or a mentor, or they want to donate, what's the best way to get in touch?
Brilliant. So if they want to become a volunteer mentor, just simply want to know a little bit more about that, call Donald. He's our program manager, and I'll give you a number. Well, you can text him, 021-462-830. That's 021-462-830. Or you can simply go to our website, which is upside.org.nz. That's upside.org.nz. And there's also a little donate button there if you want to set up a $10 a month. That would be amazing. Or you might have $1,000 in your back pocket. Amazing. We certainly need the help right now in this tough economic climate. We'd be super grateful. And we'd certainly love to hear if you would like to be a mentor.
Jenny, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, a delight. Thank you so much for having me on, Simon.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Time to open the mailbag this morning and share views from listeners across New Zealand and actually across the world. There's been a number of people commenting from overseas as well. Look, the mailbag is a wonderful time to hear what people think of the show and think of our guests. For those of you who need a reminder or those who are new, you can do so by emailing inbox@realitycheck.radio. You can text 2057, or of course you can go online to social media, onto RCR's Facebook page. You can even jump onto my own Facebook page and leave comments. And can I encourage you to do so? I think one of the real strengths of RCR is that actually you get to have your say, you get to share your views. So obviously, let me know what you think about the different interviews, what you think about the interviewer's angles and perspectives. Obviously, any of my opinions, let me know what you think, if you agree, if you disagree. But I also welcome thoughts on other guests we should have or topics we should explore. So, as I say, use the avenues that we have available. So, again, inbox@realitycheck.radio if you want to email. Text is by 2057. A lot of this week's mailbag focuses, not unexpectedly, around my interview with Kylie Black. She was the young lady who has what's known as Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And as she explained it, the collagen in her body, as it is for all of us, the collagen which binds and holds so much of our body together, for her, is breaking down or has broken down, and it leads to a whole raft of medical complications. So she shared her story, and not unexpectedly, you as listeners have responded. So I'm going to take some time to read through quite a number of responses, partly because I know Kylie will be listening in, and I think it's a wonderful encouragement. And can I actually say in advance a big thank you to all of you? Your responses to her are amazing. But I also wanted to read a number of them, even though at some levels they repeat. Because in a world that can sometimes be quite negative and fraught and fractured, it's actually nice to have positive, in many ways, generous sentiments. So Paula says, legend lady, which I think is a wonderful way to sum things up. Anya says, I hope I pronounced that name right, but she says, wow, I am 9 minutes into listening and my mind boggles. What a life Kylie has. We need you to talk to as many medical staff as possible, please. So thank you so much for sharing your story in public. And as a new nurse, this is so valuable for my practice. And Anya says also, I love the question you live with. What can I do now with what I have? And doing and living life for others distracts from one's own misery, which is a great strategy to make one's life more bearable when times are tough. Frankly says, thank you so much, both of you. It's so hard to raise awareness of these often lesser known complex disorders and dynamic disabilities. Much love to you, Kylie. Erin says, what an absolutely incredible interview. So inspiring. Thanks so much for bringing so much awareness and encouragement to the EDS community. It's such a beast of a condition. Hearing it talked about, but with such a positive and empowering spin is fantastic. Love this so much. Lindley says, another wonderful RCR interview, and what an inspiration. Thanks, Kylie and Simon. Tanya says, wow. One word for Kylie, inspirational. It had to be shouted, says Tanya, and she's written it, and it's in capitals. So yes, inspirational, to empower, encourage, educate, and equip. Wise words. And for those of you who had listened to the interview, you'll know that those were four words that Kylie lives by: to empower, to encourage, to educate, and equip. And as you also heard, and it was one of my learnings, Kylie loves things in sets of four. So again, her motto, if you will, empower, encourage, educate, and equip. No name for this one, but it says, Simon, thank you for letting Kylie Black talk on her condition. She is a strength, such a difficult place. She is inspiring. A psychological place she is in, so try and keep her positive place. She would need to be checked in daily, and much love to her. Well, I know Kylie is surrounded by some amazing people, from her partner to her family and friends, but I think that's quite true too. And another one, no name. Amazing interview with Kylie. What an inspirational lady. So courageous, so brave. By the way, I always smile at people in wheelchairs. They notice when I don't. And wow, take care, Kylie. Robin says, thanks, Kylie and Simon, an inspirational discussion. I was never sure how welcome inquisitive children's questions would be. I guess as the adults, just ask the person how they feel about speaking with a child. And as Janet says from Whangarei, what a bloody amazing lady Kylie Black is. I'm in total awe. And then it comes with a whole lot of heart emojis, hand up emojis, and haloed, as in a little emoji with a halo over their head. So thank you for that, Janet. And seeing I'm also originally from Whangarei, hello, doubly so. And then Stella says to finish, hi, Kylie. One of my daughters has Down syndrome and calls her support workers co-workers. And she's asking, how long is it that the EGL trial, so that's Ensuring Good Lives, is going to last? It's been going on for years, and I'm in an area that does not have it. So that was a question from Stella. I haven't been able to put it to Kylie, but Enabling Good Lives has been a way to provide some financial independence. So this is for listeners to quickly understand. EGL, Enabling Good Lives, is an initiative from a few years back to, in a sense, give the money directly and support to the likes of Kylie and others, and they make their decisions rather than it being imposed on them. I'll see if I can find out, Stella, through Kylie or elsewhere, to answer that question. Switching from Kylie, again, no name, which is fine, by the way. One doesn't have to put their name to things, but this is to do with my interview with Sunil Sharma in the recent UK elections. They say, sorry, Simon, but it's ridiculous to think that the UK Labour government are going to change anything. The same power brokers who installed Rishi, so that's the now former Conservative Prime Minister, the same power brokers who installed Rishi are the same ones that ensured Starmer won. The COVID debacle pulled back the curtain and showed us democracy is a sham. they will just continue down the path of global tyranny, just as the Conservatives did. Let's see. I think it can be actually a valid point. It's been made across a number of democracies, including here in New Zealand at times, that there isn't all that much difference or much light, if you will, between the major political parties. But we will see. Patrick was commenting on my monologue when I was discussing Susie Wiles and, you know, elements of bullying. Patrick says, did I just hear you right, Simon, that you compared John Minto with Susie Wiles? What a joke. I stand by that. The comparison is not about their issues. It's just how those who are very much out front pushing their agenda, the moment they need to or can, they will quickly become the victim. And so I suppose that's what I was arguing with the Susie case, that she was very happy to push her view, but as some people began to push back robustly, then all of a sudden the victim. And why I use the John Minto analogy is I've often seen that with the various protest movements. They turn up, they cause massive disruption, yell and scream quite bullishly. And the moment the police step in, next minute they switch to being the victim, and they're crying and accusing the police of heavy-handedness. I just think it's a tactic that bullies often use. And the final bit of feedback coming through the mailbag is to do with Senator Pauline Hanson's interview. And this is from Duncan, who's in Brisbane. He says, hi, RCR, really enjoying your content. I note you talked to Senator Pauline Hanson. She has upset a lot of her base in coming out so publicly as pro-Israel, seemingly out of the blue. One Nation, so that's Senator Hanson's party, One Nation were an obvious choice for most freedom types, including myself, and now there's a big question mark over that. However, to her credit, she and her team are still fighting on. So that's Duncan from Brisbane. So great to know we have people on the other side of the ditch listening in. And though, guys, I'll leave it there as quite a long and big mailbag, and a particular, well, thank you to all of you for writing in, but can I say a particular thanks to those of you who have written such encouraging words to Kylie, as I know she'll be listening in, but I'll make sure she receives those as well. And if you have any thoughts on the interviews today or on any topic, please get in touch with me via inbox at realitycheck.radio or text 2057.
You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
And just like that, another week of Speak Free comes to a close. 2 hours has zipped on by. As I noted at the start, this would have a particularly United States focus after the assassination attempt on Donald Trump, along with everything else that's been happening around the presidential election. It was going to be the primary focus of today. So thank you for indulging my own thoughts. We had, of course, Dr. Ruben Steff along from Waikato University with his perspectives, Dr. Anita Abbott with the more geopolitical lens that she wanted to put on things. Of course, Bruce, how can you talk American politics without having my mate Bruce on board? And, well, always like having him on. And then, of course, Jenny from Upside. I hope you enjoyed that, a little insight into the important work that she leads. Well, she and the team. Really do encourage you to get involved if you have a heart for that. As I said, though, before the interview with her, I would really welcome your thoughts on what I should call that segment, because I have some other people and charities lined up. So if you've got a thought on that, let me know. And in fact, if you have charities you think I should be talking to, let me know. So email any thoughts on those or on anything you've heard today. Email inbox at realitycheck.radio. Or text 2057. You can always leave messages on social media as well. But look, I've enjoyed doing the show with you all today. There'll be no shortage of topics to discuss next week. But, well, stay online. Stay listening, because up next we have the Fourth Estate.
Celebrating Western values, our democracy, and our rights. And hearing perspectives from right here in New Zealand and overseas. We live in a big, well-connected world. So join Simon O'Connor as he talks to guests from home and abroad about the issues that really matter. Join us at 10 a.m. every Friday, right here on RCR,
Reality Check Radio.